Hello, everybody. Hi, how are you today? I'm Karen Hartglass, and thank you for joining me today. This show is called It's All About Food. And guess what? We'll be talking about food. But we talk about a lot of different things on this show and connect the dots with how food is related. It's Halloween today. What are you dressed as? Well, like I told you last week, I'm going to dress up as a compassionate vegan. It's something that I try and do every day, actually. I don't have a costume on. I'm just me. That doesn't mean I don't like to dress up. It's just we've been on the road for almost a month, and we leave tomorrow to go back home. I'm really looking forward to that. And my partner Gary and I have been in Northern California since October 5th. We've had a number of projects here. Right now I'm sitting in Walnut Creek, and I've got this lovely view of the trees, some fall colors, something that I've missed not being in New York. So I'm glad I get a little of those yellow and red hues out there. Autumn is my favorite season of all. The cool, crisp air, it's a great time for soups and hot tea, those comforting, cozy things that I love. And I'm always learning when we're traveling about how to stay on the path of healthy eating and healthy living, because life continues to throw us challenges. And when we have a routine, especially at home, I think it's easier to stick to the agenda, stay on the path. It's more challenging when you don't have everything around you to keep you familiar with things. But one of the things I've really enjoyed, and I highly recommend it, is walking. There are some wonderful trails out here, the Contra Costa trails, and I've been going on them not every day, but as often as possible. It was really hot here, and then it got cool, and it's been kind of fun to do the walk and with different kinds of weather. But walking is wonderful in so many ways. Excuse me. When I'm at home in Forest Hills, which is Queens, one of the five boroughs of New York City, we walk there too. And there are some crazy spots, city streets, but there are also some wonderful parks. And the point I'm trying to make is there are some great free places to go, public spaces that you can take advantage of and walk. It's good for you. You can walk fast and make it a power walk, or you could make it a zen walk and walk in an even, comfortable pace. You can meditate during your walk. You can talk with someone while you're doing it. I highly recommend it. I'm going with a few themes the last few weeks. I think I mentioned Lynn Twist last week. I had watched the Prosperity documentary by Pedram Shojai, and he had a number of interviews available in his roadmap for prosperity, and I only got to watch one or listen to one. Oh, no, watch. It was a video, and that was with Lynn Twist. And when I heard it, I thought, I want to find out more about her. When am I going to find the time to do this? Well, I do a number of different projects for money, for income. I have my nonprofit, Responsibility and Living. I do some musical theater work, singing and directing. And I also do some vetting of people's programs for other businesses to see if it's something they want to promote. And sure enough, just when I said to the universe, I'd like to learn more about Lynn Twist, I was offered an opportunity to vet her program, which I did. And there were a few nuggets that I got out of it that I just want to share with you. The whole program she offers is great, but there were a few themes, and I got it from the Prosperity video, Prosperity interview, and you can probably find these things online. But one of them that keeps replaying in my mind is that we've been socialized to be consumers rather than citizens. And consumers are here to consume, and citizens take care of the community. And I keep thinking about this. Am I doing something right now that I am, where I am being a citizen, or am I doing something where I'm being a consumer? And it's a great thing to ask yourself from time to time. Are you helping the community, or are you just taking? And sometimes it's not that obvious. Another piece that I liked was the term forgiving. Forgiving. And it's just like other words that we use, like the word disease. A lot of people like to break it up and say disease is dis-ease. And it's great to take the words apart. So with forgiving, when you're being lovely and generous to someone who may have done something that wasn't especially nice, you're actually giving them, you're giving them your love, your understanding, your compassion. And it feels good. It feels good to ourselves when we forgive, when we're being generous like that. Anyway, so I'm enjoying these concepts and words. And the last thing that I got from this program was coming up with what you stand for. Who are you and what do you stand for? And sometimes when we're in a conversation that could turn divisive, could turn really argumentative, me versus you, them versus us, black versus white, what I got from the program is if we just talk about what it is we believe in and what we stand for, the people that we're communicating with will be more open and receptive to hearing our message, and it won't get so defensive. So what do you stand for? I know what I stand for. I stand for peace, sustainability, freedom, not exploiting people, non-human animals, the planet, trying to help reduce pain and suffering on many, many levels. Now, pain and suffering, I'm not saying it's a good thing, but sometimes we do learn from a little pain and suffering, but there's a lot that's unnecessary and should be reduced to a great extent. So that was some things I learned about Lynn Twist. I get comments from you listeners. Thank you very much. I love them. Please continue to find me and give me your ideas, your thoughts, your comments, questions. I'm at info@realmeals.org. Info@realmeals.org. And I wanted to just give a thank you to Julieta, who wrote a few things about the program last week and some of her comments. And we were chatting about Halloween last week, and we didn't really get into the history and kind of made a comment that we weren't that familiar with it. And I just want to say I'm not a historian. I'm not someone who, you know, knows what's happened in detail from the past. I don't think many of us do, and I rely on Wikipedia for a lot of things. But the point that we were trying to make was that Halloween, like so many other things in our society today, have become consumer events rather than citizen and community events. And Halloween, it's believed, is something that originated from an ancient Celtic harvest festival. I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce the name of the festival. I've looked on how to pronounce it, and it doesn't make any sense to me. It's S-A-M-H-I-H-A-I-N. Can you pronounce it? Samhain? Something like that. And this day was to mark the end of summer and the harvest and the beginning of the dark, cold winter, a time of year that was often associated with human death. And there was a belief that this boundary between the worlds of living and dead was blurred, and they celebrated on the night of October 31st this boundary time when ghosts of the dead return to Earth. Now, this is what some people believe. I can't verify it, and again, it's just something that I found on the Internet. But I think it's important to talk about some of these pagan beliefs where the idea that we were connected to the earth and all things inanimate and animate, like rocks and life, that everything had an energy, everything had a life in it, even if it was inanimate. And we've gotten so far from that that, well, we do so much where we're exploiting everything that we can. So on this holiday, on every day, I want to focus on being a citizen, being in community. You know, I remember trick-or-treating as a kid, and it was really fun because we'd go out in our neighborhood, and there were lots of kids, and we'd knock on people's doors, and it was great fun. And a lot of people can't do that anymore because we have so much fear about not trusting our neighbors. And I think when I'm at home and I want to offer treats for people, I always think the best treats would be if I could make something, like I could make a little cookie or these different kind of fruit and nut balls, things that would be delicious and sweet and small and wonderful. But you can't really do that anymore because if you're giving them to strangers, people don't trust what other strangers are going to give them. They have more trust for what they get packaged in a store that's hopefully met all of the rules and regulations that our government has set up for healthy food. It's crazy, isn't it? We've gotten so far away from sanity. One thing that Julieta also mentioned in her message to me was she recommended Go Macro bars, and I looked them up at gomacro.com, and they have these wonderful bars that are made from cold-pressed nut butter, nut butters with flavors, and they also make minis, which I imagine would be a great little treat to give away on Halloween. So if you haven't picked up your treats and you want something healthy and tasty, you might want to try that. And talking about the history of Halloween, I want to say that history in general is important. I was in a restaurant this past week, the Happy Hooligan. It was really, really fun and excited to discover it. It's all vegan. In some ways, it's like a vegan fast food restaurant or a comfort food restaurant. That's how they describe it. And we had two servers, Rachel and Shannon were their names. They're both really very nice. And talking with one of them about being vegan, she was vegan for 5 years, and I said I was vegan for about 30 years. And what was interesting was how she really didn't know some of the people that I consider the great leaders of this movement. And that's fine. We can all come to the same point of understanding that we shouldn't exploit, and we don't have to know about all the books that have been written and the films that have been made. But sometimes it is important to know because we don't want to take anything for granted. I feel the same with the women's rights movement, that there were so many women and men that worked very hard to pass laws to make life better for people. And years later, when we have rights and privileges, when we have all kinds of wonderful vegan foods in the store, we kind of forget the fight. Things are too easy. And I think it's helpful to go back, review history, see how not that long ago things were pretty different, and we don't want to go backwards. We don't want to lose the benefits. We don't want to lose the choices, the freedoms that we have. And if we take things for granted, then we don't continue to fight for them. And we have a long way to go in terms of things that need to be fought for, because life for many humans and life for many non-humans is not easy, not pleasant, not pain-free. We have a lot of things to fight for. I wanted to mention Title X. I have there's a store called Title X, and there is a federal law called Title X, and I just wanted to bring it up because I like the store title X. They have a lot of comfortable, nice clothing for women that's somewhat sports related. And I love the name. And I wonder if how many people ask themselves, why is it named that? Because we need to know. Title X is a federal law, and it's considered part of the United States Education Amendments of 1972. And it says that no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. And it was written as a byproduct of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it's really been helpful getting girls more opportunity in schools with sports. And this is something that we need to continue to fight for, because I don't think it's entirely been put into place in all cases. And I think there are some opportunities to lose the benefits of Title X. So anyway, I like the store Title X, and I like the law Title X. And back to the history of the vegan animal rights movement. Vegans existed long before the name was coined. The name was coined in 1944 by Donald Watson of the Vegan Society in England. And it meant non-dairy, vegetarian. And the word vegan today also, a lot of people are trying to expand on it, or kind of like the definition of organic too, where people don't want to stick to the meaning of it. They want to loosen it up a little. And I say, just add more words. Don't change the meaning, just make up another word. Because it's good to have specific clarity of everything. So tonight, I don't know if you're aware of this, tonight is a plant-powered power hour. And we've been doing these for a few years now. It's a power series with John and Ocean Robbins. It's free. And there will be three dates. One is tonight, and then a couple more in the next few days, where John and Ocean will be interviewing Dr. Susan Pierce-Thompson, Dr. Dean Ornish, and Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn. And they'll be talking about how to make healthy eating fun. And then after this program, you'll get the opportunity to participate in our course, Plant Powered and Thriving. And I say our course because this is something that John and Ocean and I have put together. And it's a 6-lesson class. It's really wonderful, and I enjoy every year that we do it. So if you want to find out more about it, you can go to responsibleeatingandliving.com, responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's where I live. And right there on the homepage is the information for the plant-powered and thriving expert series. Okay? Fantastic. So I've been here in California for almost a month, as I mentioned before. It's been wonderful, as always. And I've really been enjoying eating. And I just want to share some of the things. You might find them on the, you will find them actually, on the responsibleeatingandliving.com site with my blog, What Vegans Eat, where I post every day what I eat, and in a few days, we're going to reach post 1,000 days of vegan eating. If you're curious about going vegan or eating more plant-based, here are 1,000, almost 1,000 days of how to do it. And many times we put recipes in there. So what's been kind of fun is putting together creative meals here when I'm cooking with very few ingredients because we're traveling and we don't want to do a crazy amount of shopping. And so you can see what's been done. Now, I discovered a number of things. Have you ever tried red rice? Raise your hand, red rice. There are some Asian restaurants now that offer brown rice and sometimes multigrain rice, and you might see little flecks of red rice. Well, there are many varieties of rice. There's brown rice, black rice, red rice, and then short and green varieties. When you mill it and take all the good stuff off it, you have white. There are different varieties where they have profound fragrances like basmati and jasmine. Rice has been sustaining humanity for a very long time. And just like many foods, we have been encouraged to eat just a few of them because a lot of these large-scale farms like to monocrop and just grow one thing. And fortunately, there have been more heirloom varieties that are offered. Sure, they're more expensive. But something that I stand for is, as a consumer who really wants to be a citizen that supports the community, I put what resources I have into quality foods and foods that don't wreak havoc on the planet. And these other rices are very nutritious and fun. So I'm learning about red rice, and one of the things I learned, because I made a big pot of it and I was eating it throughout a few days, is it has a very earthy taste. And Gary actually said, well, you're trying to say it tastes like dirt, but I wasn't actually saying it tastes like dirt. But I just found that when I make cereals in the morning, for example, I'll usually add nuts and seeds and dried fruits and things like that, and I found it doesn't go with that. Brown rice does. Brown rice has a nice mellow nutty flavor. The red rice, it's almost like that red color, like a beet, but a beet can be sweet too, but it's not sweet. It's more on the bitter side. And I struggled for a few days. I don't waste food, and I made my cereals, and they weren't terrible. They just weren't wonderful. But I love red rice as a savory food. This is my opinion. If you've tried red rice and you've made it in a variety of ways, I'd love to hear about them. So please share with me your red rice discoveries. And I'm really into eating more color. I had a dish recently that had red bell pepper, red onions, and red rice. There were some other colors in it, too, but it's just kind of fun to go that way with different foods. Another of my favorite foods this week that just seem to go on together forever and ever is cauliflower. And here's something that I found was amazing to me. I just go nutty over these crazy little discoveries. I steamed up a pot of a big head of cauliflower, and I could eat like a third of it myself. And then I put the rest of it in its steaming water in the refrigerator and let it chill there overnight because I knew I would eat it in the next few days. The next day when I had it, it was sweet, so sweet. It was not that sweet the day before. I don't know what happened, but it was absolutely delicious. The simplest things, cauliflower steamed. A lot of soups and stews, for example, when you prepare them and you let them sit for a day in the refrigerator, of course, the flavors tend to marry and harmonize together and become just spectacular. I was just surprised with this cauliflower. Anyway, do you love cauliflower as much as I do? Yes. Well, in a few minutes, I will be bringing on a guest And we will be covering a very serious and important topic, and that has to do with the food we grow and the soil that we grow it in, and something that requires a lot of conversation from all of us. And I'm looking forward to the conversation in a moment. But before we do that, I'm just checking my notes to see that I covered everything that I wanted to talk about here. As I grab my Ticino, I have another question for you. I am looking into stainless steel thermoses, and I'm borrowing one right now that I'm pouring some hot Ticino from. And we're really loving the Ticino because it's a grain-based beverage that tastes like coffee, and it doesn't have caffeine in it. So I'm going to have some right now. But my question is, I'm looking for the ideal stainless steel thermos because we are going to be in rehearsal soon for the musical, The Music Man. And I really don't like going to these coffee shops and getting my tea or beverage in a paper cup. And I want to find the best stainless steel thermos out there. So share your thoughts with me. I'd appreciate it. Great. Well, you know what? I want to move on to the next part of the program, shall we? Great. So let's do that as I pull up one last piece of paper. Very good. I want to bring on my guest for today. Josh Tickle is a Sundance Award-winning film director, best-selling author, and thought leader. His films and books focus on critical big-picture social issues, including alternative energy, conscious capitalism, and reversing climate change. Josh's first movie, Fuel, won the Sundance Audience Award for Best Documentary and two theaters globally. He recently co-directed the 2017 Lionsgate release, Good Fortune, the rags-to-riches biopic of Paul Mitchell and patron co-founder John Paul DeJoria. He regularly films and interviews luminaries such as Elon Musk, Dan Aykroyd, Woody Harrelson, Sheryl Crow, and Shailene Woodley. And a lot more you can find out about Josh Tickle on the bio that I've listed on my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. But right now I want to talk about his new book, Kiss the Ground. Josh, thanks for joining me on It's All About Food. How are you today?
I am great. How are you?
I'm pretty good now that I've poured myself a cup of Ticino. Have you ever tried Ticino?
I have, as a matter of fact. When my wife was pregnant, with both of our children, you know, she loves coffee, and that was our that was the go-to drink in our household for a good 2 years, and still sometimes is. It's a wonderful, wonderful drink.
Yeah, well, I'm enjoying it right now, and I'm just sharing it with you, even though you're not here in the same space. I just like to kind of create a cozy Ticino atmosphere.
Okay. Well, I feel the warmth. I feel the warmth, and especially on a chilly October day, the last day in October. Here we are, getting ready for pumpkins and all of that great stuff on Halloween.
Right. Are you dressing up today?
My daughter, my 3.5-year-old daughter asked me the same question. I am thinking of dressing up as a farmer.
Oh, good. That's good. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's jump right into that then. You've got this book, which is going to be released in mid-November, called Kiss the Ground. Great title.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, it comes out in a couple of weeks. I'm very excited about it.
Okay, so you talk a lot about repairing humanity's relationship with nature. This is a big mouthful, big thing to digest. I mean, we have done just about everything wrong that we possibly could. could do with nature, haven't we?
Well, that's definitely one perspective, and to some degree, I do take that perspective without sort of a blame or a scolding in the book. It's you know, the perspective that I take in the book is that what nature has is this incredible restorative capacity, and we're still operating in a sort of civilization 1.0 model, which is force nature, dominate it, turn it into what we want. And we've taken that to a new level with chemical industrial agriculture in the United States, which really hasn't been around for that long. It's kind of a post-World War II experiment. But it's an experiment whose time has come to an end. And so the question is, what's the next phase? You know, what's the next phase of feeding humanity? What's the next phase of clothing humanity? What's the next phase of building and living? How does that all work when we've got many more humans? We're still expecting to be at 10 billion people by 2050. So how do we do all of that with a nature that has been, you know, a global set of ecosystems that have been compromised collectively? How do we, you know, the old concept that sort of came out of the 60s and 70s was sustainability. You know, we want to sustain. We had done damage, and so we had to do better than damage. We had to sustain. But really, if you look at sustainability, we don't want to sustain these ecosystems in their state of fragility or in their state of damage. We actually want to restore ecosystems. So the question
becomes...
Well,
we have to restore
right?
them, Josh. Yeah.
Right. Time is
the essence. If we don't restore them, there are a lot of bad predictions about where humanity is going to go. So we have to.
We have to. And really, you know, with or without the predictions, because, I tend to focus on hard science in the book, Kiss the Ground, kissthegroundbook.com for more information. And what we look at isn't the sort of big predictions, but the sort of hard science. Where are we at? Where are we at in terms of, you know, food, in terms of soil, in terms of water? And if you really take all of those graphs and numbers and charts, they boil down to two things. Very simple. Since approximately 1950, we have reduced the arable land on Earth from where it stood at about 6.5 or 7 billion hectares, and we've just reduced that back to about 5 billion hectares. Mm-hmm. We've increased the world population, meanwhile, by about 2 or 3 billion people, and we're about to do that again. So at some stage, those two curves begin to intersect, and you have way more people than you have the ability to grow food, because your ability to grow food is going down. You've desertified the soil, you've ripped the topsoil away, and your population's going up. So in terms of the big scary predictions of the future, you know, ice caps melting and all of that kind of stuff, I don't deal with any of that. What I deal strictly with in the Kiss the Ground book is how to repair those two graphs. Because the population graph, that will level off, but the future that we're living into is not good unless we repair the soil graph, because all of our food comes from soil. And yes, I know you can grow food in the oceans. I realize that we can do things like we can grow food in vertical gardens and greenhouses. But ultimately, the 5 billion hectares that sustains humanity right now, that 5 billion hectares is in danger. So we don't want to sustain that 5 billion hectares. We want to restore it. We want to increase its fertility. We want to regenerate it. And that's what the book is about. It is about regenerative agriculture and how we do that on a scale. If you're listening to this in New York City and you've got a balcony, if you've got a windowsill, you can do regenerative agriculture. If you've got a rooftop, mm-hmm. you can do regenerative agriculture. And certainly, if you are somebody who eats, which most people listening to the radio program are, you can participate, and you already participate in agriculture. Every day when you eat, we participate in agriculture.
Well, this show is all about food, and we've been talking about this along with many other issues related to food for a long time. And soil is just about everything. And it's kind of fascinating because from a science point of view, at first we were looking at everything from a macro perspective, and this is in terms of agriculture, and it's also in terms of human health. And now we're starting to look at the microscopic level because we have the tools to do that. And it seems like all the answers and all the mystery is at that microscopic level with the bacteria and the bugs and the life that's required in our soils. And we have been systematically for the last few decades killing that life in the soil, and we need to bring it back.
And that is exactly the crux. That's the crux of the argument in the book, Kiss the Ground, kissthegroundbook.com. And what I think readers will find fascinating with this book is this book is a toolkit. It's a journey around the world interviewing the top farmers, the top scientists, the top people who are involved. And it's also a toolkit for readers to begin to get involved in this regenerative agriculture in their own lives. So, you know, look, we're very used to the bleak and dark picture of the future that we all see in documentaries, and now we see it in fictional films. The question that I want to leave listeners with today is, will you participate? Will you join me? Will you read this book? Will you become a reader? Will you become a member of this regenerative revolution and get involved in restoring nature? It's amazing. It is possible. I've seen it done in different parts of the world. You know, we can restore agricultural systems, whole ecosystems, within a matter of 2 or 3 or 4 years, very short periods of time. I'm talking taking things from a desertified place and restoring them. Now, sometimes it takes longer, but it is almost always possible. And that's the exciting news in the Kiss the Ground book.
Well, I agree with you that there are many things that we can do to turn things around, and some of them don't take a lot of time. And the work is getting the education, getting the momentum, getting the support and the resources to do that. And that's not easy.
It is not, you know, I think, look, I think you're right. I think it's not easy. But I think the biggest thing that we have to change is the gray matter between our ears. Ultimately, this is ultimately a psychological shift on a global scale. Right now, the majority of what Americans eat comes from a bag, a box, or a carton, or even a tube. Okay, so that's about 65% of our daily diet. A lot of it has been forced into our diet with very, very subtle things that, you know, permeate our entire dietary choices. Corn syrup is one of them. Soy oil, corn oil, canola oil. These things are extremely deleterious to our long-term health. But they're in almost all of our packaged foods. And so if you look at what America grows, the vast majority, 80% of what America grows, is dedicated to just four crops: corn, soy, hay, and wheat. The vast majority of those crops are fed to animals in feedlots. So we have a food system that at its core maximizes empty calories, maximizes the deleterious effects to our health, and maximizes profit. What it minimizes is it minimizes really the long-term effects. You know, it tends to obfuscate what's going on with our environment and with our bodies. And so one of the big ahas in the book is the health of the soil and the health of your body and the health of the climate are directly related. Sick people, that is a consequence of unhealthy soil. An unbalanced climate, and this is a huge realization because we focus on carbon dioxide emissions from cars and factories and coal. Not that we shouldn't limit those emissions, not that we shouldn't roll them back. That makes sense. But the real driver that's really going to balance the climate is going to be the soil. That's where the power is. So if I said, look, if I can make you healthier, if I can get you to live longer, you can have a better quality of life for yourself and your children. The atmosphere that you breathe, the pollution around you, is going to vastly reduce. And you are going to create wonderful, powerful nutrition for generations to come. Wouldn't you say yes?
I say yes. What I want to focus on are the things that you and I agree on. And I want to say this because there are things that I don't agree with you, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I said earlier in the show, what am I today for Halloween? I'm a compassionate vegan, but I'm a compassionate vegan every day, so it's not a costume.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you can understand what some of the things in the book that you talked about that I personally might not agree on. But there are many points that we do agree on, and the numbers of all of us who agree on all of these things is where our energy should go in the first steps, at least. And so you mentioned all of the box food, the junk foods, the fact that soy and hay and wheat and corn are grown in terrible ways, big ag with pesticides and herbicides, toxic chemicals, they're monocropping, and there's no balance. There's no balance of beneficial insects and native flowers and things that can beautify a farm but also work together to nourish the ground there. And concepts like no-till, there are so many things that are important to bring the life back into our soil that we can all work together to make happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The fundamental principles of regenerative agriculture, what we're talking about is we're talking about a demand-based revolution in food. Okay, it's not complicated. This is very simple. Everyone who understands supply and demand understands ultimately suppliers will try and tweak the market. They'll try and trick us. They'll use, in the case of food, pretty packages, advertisements, things that make our brains say, we should eat that, even when it's bad for our body. They'll use every trick in the book to try and use supply to coerce demand. But it is ultimately demand that runs the agricultural system of the world. And that's what we've forgotten. So every time we put something in our mouths, we are creating a chain reaction. And at the end of that chain reaction, no matter what you eat, is some kind of farmer or rancher, okay? And that person has it in their mind that they're doing the right thing to supply you with what you're eating. Now, if you're eating something different, for instance, let's talk about vegetables, because that's something we both agree on. We need to eat vegetables, right?
Yep.
Less than 2% of the United States agricultural land is planted with what's called pulses and vegetables. Things that are green. Why is that? Why is it that we have 318 million people and less than 2% of our land is planted with what should be about 50% of our diet? And the reason is we have let supply dictate demand. We've let the food companies, the food scientists, the genetic engineering firms, the chemical companies, and ultimately we've let Wall Street tell us what we should be eating. And the result is a sick, fat, and nearly dead population. That's why healthcare costs in the United States are skyrocketing. We know that things like cancer are linked to epigenetics, that is, the genes that turn on and off based on environmental factors. The number one environmental factor that we expose our children to, that we expose ourselves to, is food. The number two environmental factor is air and water. So if we look at how is the food system going, it's not going well. What do we need to do? We need to absolutely create a demand-based revolution for the things that we know nourish our bodies and the things that we know nourish the soil. And that's something, it doesn't matter what you eat, everyone can agree on that.
You know, the farmers struggle too, and you mentioned one farmer who kind of went against the grain and was growing a diverse amount of products rather than growing corn, for example. And there are many farmers out there that will just grow what the government will insure them for with crop insurance and understand that the years when they don't make what they normally will, they'll get a certain amount of reimbursement back, but they're not growing anything that's really that people want or that's healthy. And they could, you demonstrated that they could actually do a lot better if they weren't in this kind of mindset that they can't give up their subsidy. They can't give up this protection.
Yeah. It's a tough issue. Ultimately, demand is the most powerful tool we have. Government is a powerful tool. Government is currently dictating the system. Government is currently driving the system into the ground, so to speak. And we talk about all this in the Kiss the Ground book, kissthegroundbook.com. Okay? Now, one of the things that we need to really look at is the power of how do we restructure our finance systems. Right now, an average farmer in the United States, their goal today, as of 2017, is to make $20 an acre a year. That's really low, okay? Mm-hmm. We just did a survey with one of our partners. 525 corn farmers in the state of Nebraska, we asked them, are you making profit with no government subsidy? Are you making profit? 524 said no, meaning the government is the only tool they have to make that $20 an acre. Now, we know from regenerative farmers like Gabe Brown, who's farming almost 5,000 acres. That's twice the national average size of a farm. He's farming almost 5,000 acres, so this is at scale. This is not an experiment. This is not a backyard garden. This is not something a science institution set up. This is an actual real farmer rancher. He's making his average profit, no government subsidies, no government assistance, no loans, $100 an acre. He's making five times with regenerative agriculture per acre what the average farmer in the U.S. has to make with government subsidies. So that's the reality. The reality is the bottom line, how much money this puts in the farmer's pocket, is vastly multiplied. But that security blanket, you know, if you knew you were going to get a check, and this is what farmers argue, they say, if you knew you were going to get that government subsidy check, win, lose, or fail, whether your crop grows, whether your crop doesn't grow, what would you do? And so we are, part of this revolution is asking farmers to, hey, take a risk. This is going to be a transition. This is going to take time. But you don't have to put all your crops into this format of agriculture right away. Take a small portion, take 50 acres, take 100, and begin experimenting and see if you can't just make so much more money than you ever dreamed of. That's what we want farmers. That's the message we want farmers to take away.
So what are you growing?
Say that again. Sorry.
You have a garden. Are you growing some food at home? What are you growing?
Yes, we are. As a matter of fact, right now we're focusing our efforts on the number one most pesticide sprayed, most watered crop in America. And I'm talking about lawns, L-A-W-N-S, lawns, okay? Most people don't realize that is the most irrigated crop in America. It takes the most water per little acre of ground. And we actually spray the most chemicals on our lawns than any other crop. And that's, of course, think about it, folks at home, who plays in the lawn? Your pets and your children. Notice the increased incidence of pet cancer over the past 10 years? Maybe a link there. So my wife and I, Rebecca and I, we have a 5-acre avocado farm. We've been transitioning it away from chemicals and toward organic for 5 years. Again, it takes multiple years to do the transition correctly. We stopped all chemicals 5 years ago, but the actual regrowing and transition takes time. But really where we focused our efforts is on our lawn. Our lawn was dying when we arrived to California. It was a drought. And so rather than replanting turf and irrigating it more, we found 16 different seed species, many of which were native to this area or native to nearby areas, and we planted those with 5,000 worms into a big backyard area, about a quarter of an acre, 5,000 worms, 16 different seed species. We did fish emulsion and mycorrhizal fungi. By the way, you can order this stuff on Amazon. It is amazing. You can order worms on Amazon. It's incredible. They come to you in a box. They're alive. Mm. So we did that, and now instead of a lawn, we have a perennial multi-species cover crop. Not all of our species survived, okay? Probably about 10 of them didn't come up. But the six that thrive in our backyard thrive at different parts of the year. So we have clover, we've got green fescue, we've got Kentucky ryegrass, we've got different things going at different times of the year. And mostly, I'd say for about 10 or 11 months of the year, we have a really green, it looks like a lawn, the kids play in it, the pets play in it, everyone plays in it. It's beautiful, it's soft to the touch, you can lie down on it, but it's not turf. It's a mixture of things. And what that means is the root structure is a mixture of things. And the roots are interconnected because we re-incentivized the mycorrhizal fungi. We got the worms working in the soil. You can still go into our backyard and dig a thing of soil and you can still get worms. So we regenerated a little ecosystem. And so now we're taking that idea and we're planning out how we're going to do that on 5 acres, mixing in trees, perennials, fruits, vegetables. And we're going to do some animal integration. We're going to have animals coming through our little ecosystem, fertilizing and working the soil as well. So this whole little ecosystem has been our dream, but it's a miniature version of what many of these ranchers and farmers are doing. And the animal component is an important component. And what I say to folks who, you know, I was a vegan for 6 years, raw foodist for a year. I've experimented with many different food types in my body. And I respect everybody's decisions for their bodies, and especially demand-based decisions. If they're trying to move a system away from the horrible things that we do to animals today, which are just unacceptable and need to be abolished. What I say to folks who adamantly don't want to eat animals, this system doesn't require that you eat animals. But nature, there's nowhere in nature that does not farm without animals. Nature farms with animals. So we need them. The choice to eat them, that is a different conversation. They don't have to be eaten, but they do have to be part of our big systems in order to have those systems work properly.
Well, I appreciate everything you're saying. Now, we definitely need to have life where we grow food, and that life includes beneficial insects and bacteria and all kinds of organisms and worms and things. There are a number of different types of agriculture out there that don't use animals per se on the property or use their manure, like veganic agriculture, and there are different spots where it's very successful, maybe on a small scale, not on a necessarily large scale, but there are ways to do it. And if I like to say, if you feel like you need to have animals and their manure on the property, that's fine. You don't have to eat them.
Right.
But that's my opinion.
They certainly don't require that you eat them.
No.
They certainly don't. And Indians, India, there's about a billion and a half Indians that would agree with that statement. And they have cows, and they very successfully integrate cows into their lives and into their agriculture.
Yes. Unfortunately, a lot of them consume dairy, though, and we don't need to go there today.
Right, that's a whole other kind. Look, I can rail against dairy with the best of them. I'm there with you.
Yes.
In fact, one of the things that's interesting in the Kiss the Ground book, and again, for folks who want more information, kisstheground.com, there is a free one-hour seminar and a free course that you download when you get your book. It's great. I teach the course, but it's not based on stuff that I've made up. It's based on the investigation we took for 5 years around the world. The one of the cool places we went was the Harvard Medical School and in Boston, Massachusetts. And what they did is they took thousands of studies, approximately 3,000 studies, over multiple decade period of time. All of these studies, epidemiological studies on the human body and food's effects on the human body, and they derived it into a simple-to-follow guide diet. About half your diet should come from fruits and vegetables, no shock there. about a quarter of your diet should come from healthy proteins, and they stress, you'll be happy about this, things like beans and legumes. And then about a quarter of your diet should come from some kind of healthy starch. Now, what they also did is they found almost universally in their studies, dairy actually harms the human body. So they recommend, you know, they do not recommend dairy as part of their diet. It's not in the recommendations.
Well, for the most part, that's another thing when, like I was talking about earlier, the things we can agree on. There are these very passionate movements, the vegan movement and the paleo movement, but we can all agree on a number of things, that processed food isn't good for anybody. And I think we agree that dairy is not a healthy food, and that we need to eat lots of fiber and lots of fruits and vegetables. So
yeah,
let's agree on that, and let's get back to a place where we can grow some healthy food with this regenerative agriculture.
Yes, I think focusing on the places, there's so much agreement within the food movement. If we can focus on the points where we're together, we can really make a strong alliance. You know, one of the things, this book is called Kiss the Ground, and the power of soil is immense. You know, we forget soil is the basis for all above life nutrition. So we look at a plant and we go, wow, that plant is where I'm going to get my nutrition. And the truth is, no, that plant is an expression of a world of microbial activity that is happening below the soil. In fact, the plant itself gets nutrition from the microbes. The communication that that plant has with those microbes, with other plants, goes through fungus, through something called a mycorrhizal fungus. So there's
okay,
this
Josh.
Incredibly...
This is a big
yes.
Josh. This is a big topic, and we're out of time.
We're out of time. So, well, there you go.
We're out of time
more
already.
Information.
That was fast. Yes. So
yeah,
everybody, go outside and kiss
the ground.
And there's a lot more conversation necessary on this subject. Josh, thanks so much for joining me today on It's All About Food.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks to your listeners out there.
Okay, take care. I'm Karen Hartgless. You've been listening to It's All About Food, and don't forget, tonight is the Power Hour Expert Series, and if you want to find out more about that, go to responsibilityandliving.com. You can click on the home page. I'm Karen Hartgless. Thanks for listening. Have a delicious week.